The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, an Apple Premier partner. TechServe has been supporting New Yorkers for 29 years with Mac repairs and upgrades, including data recovery, liquid damage, hard drive issues, general troubleshooting, and more. TechServe.com. And An American in Paris, the new Tony Award-winning musical that brings the magic and romance of Paris into perfect harmony with the unforgettable songs of George and Ira Gershwin, winner of more awards than any other musical of the year. Tickets at AmericanInParisBroadway.com.
You know, I get greedy. I want money, money. Now I'm going to... I'll tell you what we're going to do, right? We get greedy, right? Now we're going to get greedy for the United States. We're going to grab and grab and grab.
Trump for security is the best. Trump for the economy is the best. Trump for the military is the best.
Donald Trump. Trump. Trump.
Trump. Trump.
Trump.
Trump.
Trump.
Trump. Trump.
Trump. Trump.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And the name Trump has been on the Las Vegas Strip for years. Last night it was on the ballot in Nevada, and today it is the top headline of virtually every news source in America. The slogan of the Trump International Hotel in Las Vegas is, if you can't always get what you want, you must be staying somewhere else.
You know, we weren't expected a couple of months ago, we weren't expected to win this one. You know that, right? We weren't. Of course, if you listen to the pundits, we weren't expected to win too much, and now we're winning, winning, winning the country. And soon the country is going to start winning, winning, winning.
In raw numbers last night, Trump pulled 45.9% of the vote and 12 delegates, while Marco Rubio got 23.9% of the vote and 5 delegates. Ted Cruz also got 5 delegates, but only 21.4% of votes cast. Jeb Bush, before he got out of the race, had dumped $130 million chasing the GOP base to no avail. Cruz and Rubio have done better with less money, but it's still far short of the Trump result, which on one level looks astounding, but on another level is a tiny number of people, really, voting. 34,531 people voted in Nevada. High turnout, but still a small sample of all of America. And yet the even smaller samples from pollsters are lining up for Donald Trump. Hans Noel co-authored the book The Party Decides, all about the evolution of presidential nominations. Noel's most recent book is entitled Political Ideologies and Political Parties in America. It looks at the liberal and conservative ideologies that form the basis of our modern political parties. Hans Noel, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
I would say that there's no evidence of party or ideology in any of this, so it's a thrill to have you on the program this morning, Hans.
Yeah, certainly not a lot of evidence for a party on the Republican side.
Exactly. So what's your reaction to what's going on here? And is the party chasing the candidate? Is the candidate chasing the party? It certainly doesn't look like the latter.
Our book would say that Trump shouldn't be able to win. We would be among those who discounted him initially. We would think that Trump shouldn't be able to win because we think the party doesn't like him, which is true, and that they should therefore be able to find someone that they do like and offer that champion instead, and that person should win. And they never did that. They never found somebody who they liked to put up against Trump, and this is the consequence of that.
And should I call up all those people who contributed to Jeb Bush and offer them a share in my chinchilla farming business? Since they seem to be willing to spend a lot on something that's a completely lost cause.
Right. Well, and I think what Bush tells us is that it's not just about money. Trump has a lot of money, obviously, but most of his success has not come from spending it. It's
right.
Come from free media and free attention. The larger argument in our book is that party leaders get involved and they push their candidate, and their candidate tends to win. But part of that argument is that other things that you might think matter don't drive things. So it's not just who has the most money. And it's not the case that party leaders just follow whoever has the most money or whoever has the highest poll numbers, right? Because otherwise they'd all be for Trump by now, and they aren't.
Well, let me give you a longer narrative here. And that would begin in 2008 when Obama was the candidate, and it wasn't Hillary Clinton. And the Republicans crossed their fingers and went with, the Republican candidate and were defeated by Barack Obama. And there are a lot of people in America who hate Barack Obama, who hate the Democrats, but who particularly hate Barack Obama and now particularly hate Obamacare. And the Tea Party formed, and things like, Cantor, majority leader in the House of Representatives, lost his seat because he was viewed as a Republican in name only. I'm sure you're familiar with that entertaining acronym. And we've got a belt with lots of notches here of party activists who are party insurgents taking down party preferences. And now we finally reached the GOP Super Tuesday moment, and we're about to see it happen to the presidential candidate. There is a lot of dissatisfaction within the GOP, and I would say this barn has been in flames for a while.
No, I think that's right. But the one thing I would add to that is that the Tea Party element, the folks who took down Eric Cantor, the folks who forced Boehner to effectively step aside, and then we had this crisis where we had no leadership in the House of Representatives for a while, that cleavage is not a cleavage about Trump. Right? The person in the race that's closest to that group is Ted Cruz. And so I think that cleavage is what is causing this problem, because the party was sitting in a situation where they had two, probably more than two, but let's just say two clear candidates, each of whom represented only half of the party. Jeb Bush did represent what I'll call, say, party regulars, versus this Tea Party frustrated element, which maybe that's a Ted Cruz. And that was already going to be a difficult situation. There were a number of other candidates who were also vying for those positions. And so the party is trying to find somebody who can appeal to both of those groups. Because a key part of the way we think about political parties is that Tea Party element is part of the Republican Party, just as much as the other part. So who can bridge that? Could Scott Walker? Could be Chris Christie? Maybe it's Marco Rubio. And then in comes Trump. And that just sort of sucks all the oxygen out of the room, makes it hard for the conversation to happen in the semi-public way that the pre-primary conversation does. And so that put the brakes on any effort to solve the problem. If they didn't have that initial cleavage, then Trump, who is, he's tapping into some of that Tea Party element, but he's also, kind of his own thing. Trump would have been much easier to defeat had the party not already been divided.
Hans Noll, thanks so much.
All right, thanks for having me.
Hans Noll is co-author of The Party Decides and author of Political Ideologies and Political Parties in America. Question: where is the world's largest tax avoidance operation? Is it in some morally shady but sunny island in the Caribbean? Wrong. It's in the great state of Delaware. Yes, Delaware, where wealthy individuals and multinational corporations hide assets and avoid state and even some federal taxes, and they've been doing it for decades. Bob Henley, award-winning print and broadcast journalist, investigated Delaware's special status and found that more states and more countries are in a race to the bottom to create tax havens to attract capital, and that, oddly enough, it is only Donald Trump's tax plan that would even come close to putting an end to corporations stashing cash to avoid taxes.
Delaware has come up with a situation where it has, going back to the 1790s, it had what's called and still has a chancery court, which is a special court that hears all cases related to businesses in Delaware. And they rule always on behalf of capital and the boss. And so now corporations, media corporations, every corporation, there's over a million of them, are located nominally at a mail drop in Delaware. So when Bernie Madoff wants to move some money, he sets up a Delaware corporation. When Mr. Picard, who is a special master that came after to try to fund get money for victims, the Chancery Court makes it very difficult for him to do that. So you had a situation where leftists and people concerned about corporate power are on the same page, actually, as prosecutors who've pointed out that you have everyone from Victor Bout to all kinds of mafia figures able to use these Delaware corporations to shield their ill-gotten gains.
And Victor Bout, of course, an arms trader from Russia who's right. a notorious fugitive
Right. One, in fact, it was pointed out by a GAO study that one Russian individual was able to set up 2,000 shell corporations and move $1.4 billion in and out of the United States.
Does Joe Biden love this situation? Does he have a position on it? Does the vice president care about how all this –
Well, I was able to get to the office of the governor of Delaware, Jack Markell. And
right.
what they did, they sent me a statement from the Secretary of State, which said basically, we're doing our best to police this. We're trying to be proactive, and we work closely with federal prosecutors. And you know, the government and prosecutors can get access, but they need subpoenas. And here's the problem. When you get a subpoena, what you'll end up with is the anonymous name of a corporate servicer. There's a whole business of individuals and companies that step in to represent the actual individuals who control the entity. So it's often a dead end. I might point out just incidentally that this arrangement nets Delaware over $1 billion, roughly 25% of its entire budget. So it keeps taxes down for locals and, of course, drives other states crazy because it's estimated that you lose about $10 billion in the other 49 states.
Can other states do this, or has Delaware made it an exclusive deal?
They're working hard, of course. You know, you have Wyoming and Nevada and other states vying for it. Internationally, we have dozens of tax havens racing to the bottom to try to do anything to get capital to come in. Oh, pretty please. And the same thing happening here in the states.
Donald Trump says the jobs are going to come back. The companies are going to come back. He's going to make sure that that happens. Does he benefit from this Delaware situation?
I think he does. But here's the thing. I did have an opportunity to engage him in a colloquy at a press conference when he rolled out his tax plan, one of the few actually defined things he put on the table. One of the things he does talk about doing is having a universal multinational tax so that corporations, it'll be low, but they can't get away without being taxed at all. Right now, we have about $2 trillion by conservative estimates of U.S. multinational capital that's stranded because they don't want to bring it back into the U.S. at a 35% effective corporate tax rate. Trump would, and it's kind of a progressive thing, actually say, sorry, boys, I don't care where you've got it stashed, you're going to pay some kind of tax.
So he's actually decent on this.
He is, except when you actually look, I looked at his stock portfolio, and out of the 30 most aggressive companies that use these strategies of tax avoidance, he's got major positions in 20.
So he's just smart guy, knows how to make money. Exactly. Bob Henley, award-winning print and broadcast journalist and regular contributor to CBS News, Money Watch, Salon, and City and State. He's also the political analyst for WBGO, the NPR jazz station in Newark, New Jersey. Thank you so much, Bob.
My pleasure.
The rhetoric of this election is all about communities on the brink, Americans in decline, and the anger out in the heartland that is finding voice in new candidates, insurgent voices, sounding the alarm. But the numbers show that while there is plenty to be concerned about in the U.S. economy, there are also thriving communities all over America. They are not what Atlantic National correspondent and pilot James Fallows and his wife Deborah Fallows, a linguist and author, set out to find when they decided to take a three-year, 54,000-mile journey in an airplane across America.
When you get off the East Coast or off like L.A., San Francisco, it's just a big, open country full of a lot of places you can go. In a way that's different from, but maybe more dramatic than a road trip, you can see the terrain change.
What James and Deborah Fallows found were cities prospering on their own terms, people steering clear of national politics, and as they traveled, they noticed a pattern of characteristics that healthy, happy, prosperous communities seem to all have in common.
Before we started, Jim and I thought, we really don't want to talk politics. We don't want to talk national politics, at least as any kind of opener or deep into the conversations in these towns. And so we never brought it up. Do you want to guess how many times national politics came up in the conversations when we were talking about people's towns? Close to zero.
Yeah, I bet it would probably be zero.
And we've been at this for 3 years now, so this was, you know, quite a long time before any of the campaigns started. By contrast, what people were really interested in talking about was their town and the problems they were looking at and how they were solving them. And it was clear to us from the get-go that these were towns where people were working together and that the political sense of things was one element that you would kind of push to the side in your drive to solve problems.
What are you talking about when you say local patriots? That number two, you can pick out the local patriots. That's an important feature.
What we mean is we go into some town and we just start by asking a newspaper editor or a high school principal or whatever, who makes this town go? And if there were names that immediately came to mind of people who were philanthropists or high school teachers or developers who'd taken a big stake in making the downtown function or whatever, it was a sign that people knew not that there were bosses in the town, although sometimes, of course, there was a sense of people lording it over others, but there were people who felt responsible for the welfare of that place.
Now, number four on this is people know the civic story. How does this do more than just gauge who's someone that got there, you know, a year ago and who's someone who goes back four or five, you know, generations?
I'll use the analogy of the national story of America. We all know the whole founding myth of immigrants and the frontier and the Civil War and everything that is supposedly the story of Americanism. We know it even if we think that it's misleading in various ways. And there are certain cities where they have a similar sense of themselves so that even somebody who's just arrived recently thinks, okay, here is the connection between what people did 50 years ago and what I'm doing now.
There's also an interesting case of, I think, a changing story, which is in Fresno, California, which is a pretty rough town that is now getting a whole lot better. There are a lot of young people moving there for a new reason, which is that they see it as a place that has just as much potential but is much more affordable than, say, Silicon Valley. So there are a lot of incubators starting there, and there's an incredibly active arts scene in the downtown. It's almost a kind of frontier mentality that they will make this town in that image.
Now, I'm going to clump three of these together here, and one of them seems completely obvious, and the others seem very curious. 5, 6, and 7, they have a downtown. That seems sort of completely obvious, but they are near a research university. That's an odd one. And they have and care about a community college. That one on the surface seems sort of obvious, but then when you think about it, why, if they have a research university, do we care about a community college?
So I'll give you the quick 1, 2, 3 on those, or 5, 6, 7, as it were. So the downtown, the point is that between, say, after the Civil War through about the 1920s or 1930s, America built a tremendous amount of what we think of as classic Main Street downtown. And some of it was bulldozed under in the 50s and 60s, but a lot of it is still there. And so the towns that seem to be working best are places that are restoring this. And that is really a big thing around the country of finding young people moving downtown to live, restaurants, et cetera. So Greenville, South Carolina is actually a sort of case study of how that can matter. Research universities, those are tremendous advantages. I describe them as sort of being the equivalent of a natural port where you have students coming from around the country, you have professors coming from around the world, and you have the real phenomenon of startup industries being spun off from it. The community college, I've actually become thinking community colleges are the big thing in American education because that's where the actual growing category of well-paid blue-collar jobs, as like robotics technicians and welders and all those things, are matched with people who have now low-paying service sector jobs in Mississippi and Georgia and Oregon and other places, matching people who are being squeezed out of old factory jobs to these new opportunities by community colleges.
Now, number 11 here, they have craft breweries. I mean, I have a little trouble imagining that this is a real economic indicator. It seems more like, you know, something that one of you just loves that craft breweries happen to be there. But how do you relate that to the health of individual cities?
Okay, we can guess who's taking this one.
Yes. This is something that one of us has a particular fondness for. And indeed, the ideal town, from my point of view, has a craft brewery at a small airport. But the reason it's more than a joke is there's a craft breweries and now craft distilleries are even more than locavore food and coffee shops and all that. They are proxy for a certain kind of cultural change. And I don't mean hipsters moving into Mississippi. I mean people who are entrepreneurs. There's a certain kind of startup mentality they have. These are businesses. They become actually significant businesses in a lot of places. So as I say, it sounds crazy, but see if you can find an exception as you travel around of a city that's on the way up that doesn't have a craft brewery or now a craft distillery.
We were having a little tussle over that because my number 11 would have been a Riverwalk. In every town that we went to, you could find a Riverwalk, even if they didn't have a river. And to me, it was the sign of that they wanted to make their town a nicer place to live, a place where the public could go out and enjoy themselves. And so Riverwalks and brew pubs kind of go into the same category, but they you know, they're part of the same thing, improving the texture of the town.
Thank you so much for talking with us, and good flying to you, James and Deborah.
Thanks very much, John. It's great to talk to you.
James Fallows is a national correspondent for The Atlantic and author of the book China Airborne, The Test of China's Future. His wife, Deborah Fallows, is a writer, linguist, and author of the book Dreaming in Chinese, Mandarin Lessons in Life, Love, and Language. You can find their journey chronicled in an article titled Can America Put Itself Back Together in the March issue of The Atlantic. A big part of the innovation process in America and everywhere in the world is the patent. It's intellectual property. Sounds kind of boring, but it's an inventor's insurance policy. In 2011, President Obama signed the America Invents Act, a law that overhauled the patent system and intended to open four new patent offices to pave the way for more patents and more easily obtainable patents. Hope Shimabuku is the director of one of the regional offices, the Texas Regional U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, and she says the new law works to speed up the timetable from the first brainstorm to a finished patented product.
The entire patent rate right now takes about 3 to 5 years before a patent is issued, and that's a huge challenge because software changes every 5 years. There's new technology that comes out. So I believe that the goals that are currently being set, the rate of patent pendency in order to issue a patent and review a patent, is the right direction so we can keep up with technology.
Do you think the patent is as valuable today as it was in the time of Thomas Edison?
I think, actually, that the patents today are more valuable, or they're seen as more valuable than a while ago. I think that there's been a significant change in the last decade with the fundamental shift with the America Invents Act and then the attention that is being given at the Supreme Court level. A lot of people are starting to understand the value of patents and how important a role it plays in innovation and driving innovation.
And is that to say that patents are more valuable because companies like Microsoft and Apple are buying them when they buy individual companies, as some have charged, to hold back the development of innovative technology, that the pure value of the patent serves to restrict new people coming into the field?
I think that that's one way we can look at it, in the sense that companies like Microsoft and Qualcomm and a lot of other companies that are buying assets. For example, one of the largest portfolios that was for sale recently was the Kodak portfolio. And I think companies are realizing that there is real value in owning those patents to allow others to license it from a royalty perspective, but also defensively. So one of the things that I think is going on in the industry right now is the abusive litigation tactics. There are patent trolls that are out there that are abusing the system and using patents as a weapon to get license fees that they may or may not necessarily deserve. Companies are seeing it not only as a profit-making mechanism, but also as a defensive tool in order to protect themselves and their innovations that they've created as well.
So what innovations do you hope to bring to the patent process there in Dallas, using the expertise of your community, the things that you're going to learn in your regional office?
So my vision for the regional office is really to become the beacon of innovation for the region. Our job is to be able to educate and provide resources in order for them to be successful. I think a lot of innovators don't really know what a patent is or trademark is. They may have heard of it for the first time when they watched Shark Tank, and they said, oh, maybe I should protect my intellectual property. The other area I think that we could focus on is the K-12 education. And I believe that we as an office really need to promote STEM education in the pipeline of the future. We know that innovation promotes the economy, and encouraging women and minorities to enter into those fields I think is very important.
Hope Shimabuku is director of the Texas Regional United States Patent and Trademark Office. Thanks so much, Hope.
Thank you. Appreciate it, John.
Let me apologize in advance for any facts here that may ruffle your impression of America's greatness, but here's an alarming international legacy. The nation that hosts the headquarters of the United Nations is also a nation that has flaunted international law with doctored or marginal intelligence information presented as fact, WMD in Iraq, remember that? Unilateral military operations in defiance of the UN, refusal to recognize international accords on landmines, child rights, disability rights, the International Criminal Court. This nation administers a military base technically not on U.S. territory and technically on U.S. territory, where no international law or even U.S. law seems to apply, where people can apparently be held without confronting their accusers, held for decades without even being charged. Guantanamo. This week, the president vowed once again to close the Guantanamo detention facility, and he cited a certain embarrassment over the human rights record there.
When I talk to other world leaders, they bring up the fact that Guantanamo's not resolved. It undermines our standing in the world. It is viewed as a stain on our broader record of upholding the highest standards of rule of law.
That particular prison is a very special institution, and no norms of international law, they are not respected there. It's like a legal vacuum, you know. And once again, it's not only our view. Whether it will be tackled by the incumbent administration, and some people say that chances are slim, it is to be tackled. It is to be tackled because this issue is an unresolved human rights problem.
We get lectured to by human rights activists around the world. That is Russian human rights envoy Konstantin Dolgov speaking 4 years ago. 779 people have been detained at the Guantanamo Bay detention camp since it opened in January 2002. 91 prisoners are currently at Guantanamo, and whether or not these prisoners are out in 10 months by the time President Obama leaves office, the egregious abuse of international principles of law and the pursuit of power by fiat have all been noted by the U.S. Supreme Court and legal scholars. Jennifer Daskal is a professor at American University Washington College of Law, as well as a former counsel to the Assistant Attorney General for National Security at the Department of Justice. Jennifer, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
Now, have I overstated the case here? Are you ready to walk out of the room? I mean, just step back here and give us a sense of how bad this is.
So I think there's perceptions and there's reality. So certainly when Guantanamo was first opened in 2002, it was chosen to be outside the United States, specifically as a place that would be outside the reach, as you put it, of U.S. law and international law. Things have changed. They've evolved considerably since then. And the Supreme Court has mandated that detainees at Guantanamo have the right to bring habeas corpus, saying that at least certain constitutional provisions apply to Guantanamo. And this administration, the Obama administration, has committed to abiding by the rules of international law. So I don't think it's fair to say that today in 2016 that Guantanamo is outside the reach of the law. That said, those perceptions and the history of Guantanamo persist, and they affect the world's perception of it. And the other reality is that there are still 91 detainees who are held there, some of whom who have been held for almost 15 years at this point. And that's a very long time.
As a legal scholar, would you say this is a precedent, whether it's a mistake or not, and that it in the future opens the door for actions of this kind? Or is it just universally acknowledged as a mistake, like Plessy versus Ferguson and other decisions which will presumably never repeat?
I think the mistake that is hopefully a lesson that is learned is taking detainees. These were mostly detainees that were picked up in Afghanistan in the early days of fighting after the September 11th attacks. And they were brought out of Afghanistan all the way to Guantanamo. And the end result is that it's very hard to find a solution once they're removed and brought far away to a detention facility without any disposition plan, without any effort at the time to gather the kind of evidence that would be needed to bring criminal cases that would have the kind of finality that doesn't exist, and without any kind of end game, end plan at the end of the day. Subsequently, the United States detained lots and lots of people in Iraq and lots of people in Afghanistan in connection with fighting there. But when the majority of troops pulled out of Afghanistan and when troops pulled out of Iraq, those individuals were transferred to the Iraqi and Afghan governments, respectively, or repatriated. But the problem is that with these detainees brought to the United States or outside of the United States, it creates a whole host of additional political headaches and practical headaches in terms of trying to figure out what to do with them.
So the we've gotten ourselves into a pickle, and it can't be resolved precisely because of the geography of Guantanamo. That's what makes it unique. But the pattern here is whenever things get dicey in terms of American security, whether we're talking about Andrew Jackson in New Orleans or Japanese internment in World War II or the moments after September 11th, the Constitution gets tossed aside pretty readily. We don't hold to it in these moments of crisis.
I think that's right. I think you often see a pendulum swing in response to national security crises. It's now 2016. Guantanamo was opened in response in the days after the September 11th attacks, which were at this point a very long time ago. And I think it's good news that the president is talking about a plan. He has talked about plans before, as I think most people will recall that on his third day of office, he announced a plan to close Guantanamo within a year. He has significantly reduced the population. Under his watch, about 147, exactly 147 detainees were transferred out of Guantanamo. Under President Bush's watch, 500 detainees were transferred out of Guantanamo. And now the question is what to do with the 91 that are left. And importantly, of that 91, 35 of them have been cleared already for transfer. And this is cleared not just by Obama, but by all of the heads of the relevant security agencies in the United States, the Department of Defense, the intelligence agencies, the Department of State, Justice. They have cleared these individuals as posing an insufficient, not a significant enough threat to continue to detain them. And so step number one is to get these detainees out of Guantanamo.
But it's a complicated unraveling, that's for sure. Jennifer Daskal, professor at American University Washington College of Law. Thanks so much, Jennifer.
Thank you.
And here's something to take with you today. The first swimmer, Jovan Maria Solati, in 1817. Record holders Ian Tordoff and Anne Hemmings, kayakers in this century, and many, many more. You can now add the robotic record holder, the British commercial drone operator AccuAir successfully completed a maiden voyage across the English Channel. 21.7 miles in a record-setting 72 minutes. Wasn't a jet-powered Raptor controlled by the CIA. It was a backyard weekend warrior drone that flew across the rough waters of the English Channel. The customized drone Enduro was launched from a beach on northern France and landed safely at Dover, along with its human team, which followed their quadcopter by boat. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.